Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
All right, Cindy, so we're back in the 80s.
Yes,
we
are.
I need you to have that same hairdo.
Kind of is the same,
to do this, to do this program. So what are the most ridiculous 80s dishes that you were forced to make and or created when you were working in the 80s?
I have to say that tri-colored peppers in, like, everything was pretty disturbing to me. You know, give me a roasted poblano pepper or a jalapeno pepper or, I mean, I don't know, any other kind of pepper. Sorry, pepper people, but besides bell peppers, I really don't like the flavor of them. It's one of the few things I will not cook peppers.
It's a dominant flavor.
It is. And so the tricolor pepper was in everything. So everything tasted like those. I mean, I think it was in everything. And then the other thing was the red pepper coulis. And, that was on everything.
Everything was a coulis.
Yeah. And then I think the other was melted brie. And I can't remember what people used to put on top of it, but it was like, that was
like
the
almonds
thing.
And strawberry. Yeah. Like, mm-hmm. You think you're having fruit and cheese, and somehow that's going to be lower cal or something like that.
Or it was supposed to be exotic. I'm not sure what. Well, it got overdone.
All of you kids that went to the CIA back in the Culinary Institute of America back in those days made this like Navajo fried bread.
Oh, that was good though.
Oh my God!
Oh, I
it
love
was
that.
On way too many things.
Oh really? Oh, okay.
Way
well,
too many
you know,
things.
We did a couple of things in school that I think everybody kind of. Yeah, you're right. Probably. Took.
Everybody did it because they thought it was new and cool, and all of a sudden it was bing, bing,
funny.
Bing. It was on every menu.
Yeah.
It made me crazy.
I have to say, I love that. All right, that's funny. I didn't know we ever did it. I have to talk to all my friends at school.
Exactly. When you'd have reunion time.
Right.
And
what,
so.
What are some of your, do you remember some things that shouldn't come back?
Oh, when you go to a party and there's dip out in a bread bowl.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
It was a home entertaining thing a lot more. I mean, I guess you would like it at some fern bar because there are plenty of fern bars in the 80s, right? At fern bars, you could order like a pumpernickel with like some kind of dill dip inside of the pumpernickel bread and you would like pick the pieces of off the pumpernickel off and dip
just,
it in there.
That's just wrong.
And have it with your glass of, it was still a lot of times probably a glass of Chablis, in quotes, from a box, you know, that was like super refrigerator cold behind the bar. I mean, think about wine drinking at this time in the States, right?
Right.
It was, the bartender, you know, you'd have a drink, a cocktail, and the cocktail, like it was a martini. It wasn't 77 different kinds of martinis. It was either a vodka martini or a gin martini.
Yeah.
It was a twist or olives. Or if you're a freak, you wanted a Gibson, you get grumbled at, and the guy would go pick the onions out, which I was probably one of the guys doing the grumbling if I was working behind the bar then. Or you would have a beer, which was a reasonable thing. Or it would be like beer in a shot, which meant that you were like, you were like, okay, you're actually drinking a sport. You know, or this is like my shift is over, you know, let me inebriate myself. Or if you're having wine, you want wine. Okay, I have white, I have red.
Oh, gosh.
Right?
Those are bad choices.
And then the innovation of the 80s was White Zinfandel.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I can't forget that.
All of a sudden, White Zinfandel.
Was the greatest supposed thing in the world.
9% alcohol.
Yikes.
You know, 50, 60, 70, 80 grams of sugar. Mm. I mean, it was essentially, you know, like strawberry soda with a little bit of booze in it.
Yeah.
Back in those days. It was incredibly consistently everywhere.
What was it with everybody sabering bottles of champagne in the 80s? Were they doing that up here? Because they did it everywhere in Charleston.
They've been doing that. I was working a lot in
there was a lot of that.
In Philly and then in D.C. at that time. And yeah, that was.
Yeah, it was like a big thing.
Plenty of that.
Super dangerous.
It is. I would rather just drink the champagne.
Yeah.
But then you talked about working in a place that had almost all American wine list. Then all of a sudden, again, like with the food, we all kind of looked inland, you know, into the country for inspiration. American food was a thing, and that was a trend, and it was some kind of like, you know, modern and smooth and no real rules. And all of a sudden, you know, it was American wine, and there were two kinds of wineries. It seemed like the ones that had been there already in California and a few other places.
Mm-hmm.
Like Heights Cellars or Irie up in Oregon or someone like that or these newfangled, like, you know, it was a traditional thing and all of a sudden blew up and a lot of IPO money, you know, kind of, or they got bought up by some big beverage company and all this money went into the company and they just created one wine product after another.
No, that region's changed so
much. And it was, but the 80s is, But things are still really pretty darn inexpensive. I mean, until about the 94 vintage, a lot of what is super crazy expensive, rare, collectible California Cabernet Sauvignon now was retailing for $20 and under a bottle.
Wow.
At that time.
Big change.
And, well, I mean, you look at First Growth Bordeaux, you know, that's, and we have our guest on, Bert Bassagnani. I want to talk about kind of what changed, because that was his time of really, really learning an awful lot and of the big accelerated change in American wine consciousness. The idea of going, choosing wine and food together, I don't think it existed at all in this country until then. And even then, they would still look at you like you're a freak if you're trying to work that out.
Right. So it was just kind of getting a drink. It didn't really have an association with the food.
Even if you were choosing wine, the French sommelier would be like, well, what do you like? Do you like Burgundy? Do you like Bordeaux? Do you like,
that's,
you know,
true.
Do you want to drink champagne? Mm-hmm. It wasn't, oh, you're having rabbit, you're having duck.
Let's get this with it.
Exactly.
Yeah, let's pair this. Right.
And none of that did not exist. Maybe a few of the cliches kind of existed. But, I mean, maybe in Baltimore we had our cliches. It was a can of beer and a crab cake. So, what other chefs from the 80s, any particular meals that you had in the 80s that you were, that you remember really vividly as changing your outlook on cooking and on food? It's like, oh, you can do that.
I ate a little bit in Chicago in the 80s, and really, Charlie Trotter was there, and
he'd just gotten going.
Yeah, a lot of, when I grew up in Northern Indiana, we ate in Chicago all the time, and there were still, again, just like Charleston, there were a lot of French chefs, and it was that evolution towards American cooking, and I think just having food that was super fresh again, and maybe having a steak that had blue cheese on it. You know, or something that was sort of an odd pairing, you know, that was something, a local blue cheese, you know, some sort of pairing like that comes to mind. But that's, you know, I think I worked most of the 80s, so I didn't eat out a lot in the 80s.
Yeah, I can think of probably in 1989 having a meal in the Bellevue Hotel in Philadelphia, all the way on the rooftop in a restaurant that did not succeed in any way, shape, or form, I don't think. There was a small dining room, and it was a largely French staff, and the chef was an American and the sous chef was a Frenchman, and I knew both of these guys from cooking down the street, and I went in and I had some things I'd never seen anything like, and simple things. It was poached lobster, you know, plated as a salad with mandarin oranges and fresh basil. That kind of like shocked me.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'd only ever eaten lobster as part of like a soup or lobster thermidor or something like that. I didn't imagine that you could have this light, fresh thing.
Yeah, that is.
With the lobster. That was a surprise for me. I remember going to the fish market. There was a big fish market in Philly at that time, probably a year or two before, and getting a very old Chinese man to sort of mumble at me at 4:30 in the morning through one fish after the other after the other. And he would pull a piece of flesh and tell me to taste it from one fish after the next, to try to teach me that things had different fat and different flavor and different texture by basically taking a piece of the cheek of each of the fish to make me try it.
Hey, that was something during the 80s. We used to get grouper cheeks for free, and they're delicious. And then
they started
charging for them, and all of a sudden they're, you know, they became $8-$10 a pound. And our fishmongers used to give us the cheeks from the grouper. Oh, so good.
Well, you used to get all your bones, all your chicken bones, and mm-hmm. all your veal bones,
mm-hmm.
for as long as you're buying from the butcher.
That's
the
right.
Bones they would just give you.
That's absolutely right.
And now they charge for the bones.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't think of anything else like that off the top of my head. But, you know, we ate at Masa's in San Francisco in the 80s, and I remember that being one of my favorite meals I've ever, ever had. The chef was absolutely brilliant. I'm afraid I can't remember his name, but, you know, it was one of those experiences where every single plate came out, and there was maybe a flower petal on there, or there was something that was I had never seen on a plate before, but the food really, really, it sang. It was beautifully plated, but it tasted, it was absolutely delicious. And that was what needed to be happening with food at that time.
Yeah, it wasn't just, I think that's the thing that happened with American food that had not happened. You could get flavor, but mostly it would be home cooking or a simple like superior steak or something like that. And you might get presentation at times, but to have those two actually come together at the same time, that maybe it was only in spots, but I mean, now I think you can do that honestly in hundreds and hundreds of places mm-hmm. around the U.S. Uh-huh. During the 80s, it kind of grew up in little pockets and inspired an awful lot of other people. And that's why I think of it as being really that crucible of American cooking, that inward look during that decade that changed our ability to produce beautiful food and to really compete. I think that we can do something that is as interesting or as high quality, as worthwhile as anywhere in the world food-wise, at our height. I don't know if we do it most consistently at all different levels, but at our height. And I think that only happens because of that decade and the growth in the country.
Well, and that's it. I was just thinking, you know, that was economically speaking, the 80s were a good time for us. So, of course, as you say, opulent, there people were able to spend money and were excited to eat out and really do it up. So, you know, that's where you got the big bottles of champagne going out and no one caring that what the price of food really was in a restaurant.
It also, I mean, the product was not crazy expensive. It's one thing if 5 restaurants around the country demand X or 20 restaurants around the country demand X.
Yeah.
You know, a few hotels in New York and one place in L.A. and so on and so forth. But when 6,000 restaurants are asking for the best of all of these things, the demand changes.
Yes.
Which
it's a big deal.
Makes
sense. Has its impact.
And so let's talk recipes for a couple of minutes. Maybe a recipe or two that you developed or that comes from learning about food at that time.
I think one of the favorite cookbooks at that time was the Silver Palette Cookbook.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody was using that cookbook. And those ladies did such a great job. And that was really reflective of the times. And I know one of the recipes in there that we sort of modified in the restaurant where I was doing my apprenticeship was for a chicken liver mousse. And it was just, it was so good. And a lot of people were... Oh, and I think green peppercorns were really popular in the 80s, too. I think that was another...
I think it's a little bit of a holdover from the 70s, but yeah.
But with the chicken liver mousse, you would have, again, a large sauté pan. Now, this time you're getting it very hot. So you want corn oil in the bottom or some sort of vegetable oil in the bottom of the pan. With the chicken livers, you need to purge them a little bit since they are a gland. So you want to rinse them off in cold water for a period of time and then pull them apart and pull out if there's any green pieces, you want to discard those. If there's extra fat, you want to discard that. Anything you don't like the way it looks, basically get rid of it. Chicken livers are very inexpensive, so you can be pretty specific with what you're working with. And once they've drained, and you really want them to drain, I'd actually pat them with a paper towel after that, season them with salt and pepper, and do a small dice of an onion and get maybe 10 black peppercorns, 4 bay leaves, and a pinch of dried thyme, like a quarter of a teaspoon of dried thyme. And put your chicken livers, season the chicken livers with all that and put them in the pan and brown them. You want to brown them. You absolutely cannot overload the pan. So if you have chicken livers that are more than covering the bottom of the pan, you have overloaded the pan. And you do want to have some free space in there. You do not want them to boil. You want them to brown beautifully. And you want them to cook quickly. So you want to brown them on both sides and cook them until they're medium, just barely pink in the middle. And you can just cut them in half and look at them to make sure that that's how they are. And then I deglaze that pan with cognac.
If you cook them hard, they turn into like little mineral rocks and have terrible
taste
flavor.
Terrible, yeah. So you do not want to overcook them. And then you've deglazed a pan with a little bit of cognac, and you pull them out, and you need to get them, you know, obviously you don't want the peppercorns and the bay leaves and all that, so, and you're not really using that onion product, you're going to do a fresh onion in there. So you just pull the chicken livers out and let them cool down, and they do need to cool down, and but they need to be just at room temperature. You don't want to make them cold because they won't puree as well. And you want butter that is just softened. Again, you don't want it too soft, but you want it not to be hard out of the refrigerator.
If you pull it out of the fridge when you start cooking the chicken livers, you're probably good.
Should be fine. And then I cut it into squares, probably like 1-inch squares, and cold cream and cayenne pepper, more cognac, more salt, more black pepper, and any other seasoning that you like, but that's you know, I would put a little bit of clove or allspice in, and puree them. You puree the livers in the food processor with slowly drizzling in the cream and adding the butter, and then you pass it through a tammy. Well, you don't have to, but it's nicer if you pass it through a tammy, and it's just, it's absolutely delicious. It's a great way to eat chicken livers.
Once it's through that tammy, it goes into like a, you put it into like a little pot, you know, just or like a little jar of some sort, and then you chill that down for, it's probably best after, what, 8, 10, 12 hours?
Yeah. Yes, or even the next day.
Next day, let the flavors set a little bit.
And then serve it with grilled toast, grilled baguette, or whatever, and some toast points that you like, and that's delicious. And then one of my other things, I think just from cooking in the 80s and trying to lighten something or having some of the spa influences of the 80s. Uh-oh.
Spa, what? No, that's not my warning sign about you using a spa word. I know you don't do spa food, but so what is the lighter dish from the 80s?
Just making she crab in a better way. So it's a crab soup that was not thickened with roe from the female crabs. It was thickened very lightly with a roux.
Roux instead of roe.
Yeah, and
R-O-U-X.
Right. Mostly all about the cream, a little bit about the, well, and obviously about the crab meat, and laced with sherry, and a little bit of onion and carrot and celery sautéed, ground up and sautéed into the soup. You could even, actually, my chef used to put it in the food processor, which now I would do a very, very fine dice of, but sautéing the mirepoix, the carrot, celery, and an onion, adding that little bit of a roux to it, adding the cream, crab stock if you have it, and the sherry, and just letting it cook and not making it thick, not making it all about the vegetables, but making it all about the crab and the cream.
Only in the 80s would you say you updated something, made it lighter, and still made it be about the cream. So we should put that recipe up on the website.
Okay.
Send us your email questions, foremanwolf at wypr.org. And when we come back, we're going to have with us Bert Bassagnani, one of Maryland's best wine growers.